there has been for a long time discussion of United States corporation, and there are variations of it. We are chattel to the corporation. There's just a lot of stuff out there. Most of it contradicts other articles or presentations along the same line. If you compare five of them, you'll probably find six variations of what's supposed to have happened. My research tends, especially more recently, tends away from what other people have written because they do take a lot of things out of context, and we'll get into that in just a minute. My research is based on going back to the historical documents, pulling them out, reading them, putting them in context, and understanding what the intention was, not trying to fill in voids that appear to exist and are filled in at the convenience of the author of the articles that are being presented. If you look at my articles, you'll see that I don't take things out of context. I don't take a sentence or a phrase and then try and construe something out of it that was not intended. I think, first I'm going to start off with a little background. Supreme Court frequently refers to Webster's 1828 dictionary as being a source of understanding the definitions of words as they existed in the time of the Founding Fathers. It was less than 50 years after the Constitution, and it was the language of the time. And I think the best example of that is demonstrated by Black's Law Dictionary, which defines income as gain, but also says that it's all that comes in, basically, which is what IRS says. Back in 1828, income meant gain. It didn't mean all that comes in. So when you change the meaning of a word, can you have the effect of changing the meaning of the intent of a law that was enacted using that word? So first we need to look at what corporations were back in 1828. And this is out of Webster's 1828. Corporation, noun, a body politic or corporate, formed and authorized by law to act as a single person, a society having the capacity of transacting business as an individual. Corporations are aggregate or sole. Corporations aggregate consist of two or more persons united in a society which is preserved by succession of members, either forever or till the corporation is dissolved by the power that formed it, by death of all its members, by surrender of its charter or franchise, or by forfeiture. Such corporations are the mayor and aldermen of a city, the head fellows of a college, the dean and chapter of a cathedral church, stockholders of a bank or insurance company. And a corporation's soul consists of one person only and his successors as a king or a bishop. Now, if you followed that definition, there was no indication of any entity under the definition of corporation that would manufacture widgets, for example. The closest to that would be the banks or the insurance companies. Obviously, if you put your money in a bank or in paid premiums to an insurance company, you want some assurance that there's stability to that, and that charter then that was granted to banks and insurance companies was that assurance that they could be sued as a person. Beyond that, making widgets, people talk about the corporations that existed before then. There are none. There were trusts, there were limited partnerships, there were different types of entities that were chartered, but none of them had the capacity of corporation. They were conglomerates of people, partnerships. The East Indian Trading Company, for example, was not a corporation. It was a company. It did not have the nature of a corporation. It had investors, but they had established a corporation, and the entity was completely unlike the corporations today. Now, if we look at Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition, we start seeing some significant changes in what a corporation is. An artificial person or legal entity created by or under the authority of laws of a state or nation, composed in some rare instances of a single person and his successors, being the incumbents of a particular office, but ordinarily consisting of an association of numerous individuals. Such entities subsist as a body politic under a special denomination which is regarded in law as having a personality and existence distinct from that of its several members, and by which is, by the same authority, vested with the capacity of continuous succession, irrespective of changes in its membership, either in perpetuity or for a limited term of years, and acting as a unit or single individual in matters relating to common purpose of the association within the scope of the powers and authorities conferred upon such bodies by law. So there we have two definitions that are separated by 150 years that are distinctly different. One was the corporate capacity of something established for a singular purpose. For example, there were public utilities, ferries, canal works. George Washington tried to establish canal up the river, and they had a corporation for that. But it was, in a sense, a corporate entity for government purposes. It was going to operate as a mini-government for those who wanted to use the canals or for people who wanted to use a turnpike. Some turnpikes were owned solely, and they weren't corporations in that respect. So now, I've started doing the research on the corporation article, and I haven't verified all this, but most of it is consistent with what I've found so far. But I'm going to read 6 points that have been pointed out as to corporations over the period of our history, and in Europe as well. Corporate charters or licenses to exist were granted for limited time and could be revoked promptly for violating laws. Now think of Enron. We don't violate corporations. They're too big to fail now, so we subsidize corporations. But the old concept, it was given a charter to do one thing. If it broke any laws, if it violated that charter, it could be revoked promptly. Corporations could engage only in activities necessary to fulfill their chartered purpose. So if their purpose is to make widgets, they're not in a position to buy other corporations, take advantage of tax write-offs to close another corporation and take the loss and get the tax write-offs from the first one, and actually manipulate money. They don't care about widgets anymore. And now if we think of what made this country great, what made it great was we made a good quality product at a fair price. But as you know today, the quality doesn't matter. Doesn't matter who made it. What matters is the bottom line. That's the shift in the laws that apply to corporations from when they first came into existence prior to the Civil War, and what happened to them after the Civil War. Corporations could not own stock in other corporations nor own any property that was not essential to the fulfillment of their chartered purpose. Now, that just enhances what I said about buying other corporations or investing for the sake of investing. They were there to make widgets. That was it. Corporations were often terminated if they exceeded their authority or caused public harm. Now, there's enforcement of law. If they created damage by what they did, if they dumped chemicals in the river, for example, they'd lose their charter. But now they're too big to fail. Owners and managers were responsible for criminal acts committed on the job. And now, in rare cases, is somebody sent to prison for criminal acts. And they have to be pretty severe and piss the government off pretty badly before they get prosecuted and sent to jail. Corporations could not make any political or charitable contributions nor spend money to influence lawmaking. Boy, where would we be today if it was still that way? They could not make, the Supreme Court recently ruled the corporation has the right to freedom of speech. Now, God didn't create corporations, and we know rights are endowed by God. So how the corporation got the right to freedom of speech is beyond me, unless it was handed to them on a silver platter by the Supreme Court, which it was. Their purpose is to make widgets, and that's their sole purpose. But when they start amassing large amounts of profit and use them to buy economic favor from government, they have defied the purpose of the Constitution, they have defied the purpose of their charter, and they have defied the best interest of our country. So corporations, and I don't think Pat will disagree with me on that, corporations are one of the greatest cancers we have in this country today, probably second only to Congress. Now, prior to 1819, corporations were strictly an entity of the state. They were chartered by the state. The federal government did not presume authority to charter corporations. In 1819, the Supreme Court began stripping the sovereignty of the state in a case that had to do with Dartmouth College, where the state wanted to revoke the charter. The federal government says, no, you can't revoke the charter, and took away the authority of the sovereignty of New Hampshire. Through a history then, not very much until the Civil War, but in the Civil War we began seeing corporations beginning to excel in getting judgments by Supreme Court in their favor and beginning to foist upon them a status that they should never have had, which would have been contrary to the laws of the states prior to that. Now, that gives you an idea of the brief history of corporations. So, now, there's two major elements to the most of the corporate chattel arguments that we hear or read about on the internet or back in the fax days. And first of them is a reference to 28 U.S. Code 3002. Now, what I like about this is to get things in context, you need to know where they are. Now, every article that I have read simply says 28 U.S. Code, Section 3002, definitions, print 15, in parens, quote, United States, end quote, means, parens A, a federal corporation, parens B, an agency, department, commission, board, or other entity of the United States, or C, an instrumentality of the United States. Now, that sounds well and good. It sounds like they're saying the United States is a federal corporation, an agency or department or commission or board or other entity of the United States, or an instrumentality of the United States. And a lot of people will cut out B and C and leave only, in their article, only paragraph, subparagraph A federal corporation. But to put it in context, let's look where that came from. Title 28 is judiciary and judicial proceedings. Part 6 is particular proceedings. Chapter 176 is federal debt collection procedures. Subchapter A is definitions and general provisions. So now we've put it in a different context than the United States means a federal corporation. We can see that it comes under judiciary and judicial proceedings. So this only applies in court. And then we talk here about particular proceedings. Oh, only in certain cases in court. And then we get to Chapter 176, federal debt collection procedures. Oh, well, that narrows it down even further. If you owe the government money, then the definition applies. And then when you see the style on a lawsuit that says United States versus John Doe, and it's filed under this code, it means that the term United States can be substituted in lieu of a federal corporation, an agency, a department, a commission, a board, or other entity of the United States, or an instrumentality of the United States. So all it does is create a definition and authorizes that definition to be used in the style of a proceeding in court. It does not make the United States a corporation. So when you see 28 U.S. Code 3002 in an article, now you understand where it came from. Now, when you read the article, see if it really fits what the article says it means. If you don't go back to the source, You can be easily deceived. You can have the wool pulled over your eyes quite easily. Now, there's another primary element in this whole discussion about corporations that has to do with the an act of 1871. February 21st, 1871. Be it enacted by the... Wait, I need to go somewhere else first. Let me go to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution, where it says... To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may, by secession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Okay, the authority was granted in the Constitution to take this 10-mile square and other forts, magazines, and arsenals, and other needful buildings, and that list has been expanded to some degree since that time, but basically every one of the things identified, and we'll get to that in a few minutes, is something that has two things happen. One, it has to be ceded to the United States. Not bought by them, but ceded. That means the state has to, whether the government paid for it or not, the state has to pass it on to the United States government. It has to be with the willing consent of the state. Now, there's another aspect of that, too, and that's called jurisdiction, and we'll cover that shortly, too. And that jurisdiction also has to be ceded. So there's two cedings that has to be done, one of the land, with or without compensation for the land, and two, of jurisdiction. Now, there was a case in Fort Polk, Louisiana, and I don't have the case in front of me, and I've got to track it down again, but it was rather interesting, and I read it many years ago. It had to do with a murder that was done committed on Fort Polk. Now, the question was, whose jurisdiction was it? Was it federal jurisdiction or was it state jurisdiction? Part of Fort Polk, Louisiana, was ceded, and jurisdiction ceded to the federal government. Other parts of Fort Polk, the expansion portions, were bought by the federal government. And if I remember correctly, they weren't even ceded, but they came in the fence that incorporated Fort Polk. So the first step to determine jurisdiction was, where was the murder committed? Was it committed on federal property, subject to federal jurisdiction, or outside of federally ceded and jurisdiction ceded property, where it would be tried under the laws of Louisiana? Now, that gives you an idea how back in the 1800s jurisdiction was dealt with. So here we've got an act in 1871 that says, being enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled, that all that part of the territory of the United States included within the limits of the District of Columbia be, and the same is hereby created into a government by the name of the District of Columbia, by which name it is hereby constituted a body corporate for municipal purposes, and may contract and be contracted with, sue and be sued, plead and be impleaded, have a seal, and exercise all other powers of a municipal corporation not inconsistent with the Constitution and the laws of the United States and the provisions of this act. It goes on to appoint a governor, which was years later changed to mayor. Why did they do that? Were they trying to create a corporation that would make us all chattel? Or, now wait, Congress had exclusive legislative jurisdiction over the forts, magazines, arsenals, and the 10 square miles. That means the Congress of the United States, in essence, was the city council for the 10 square miles. Well, along with their other duties, taking money under the table, kissing up to corporations and everything, they were just overburdened. They couldn't read a 1,300-page document. They did not have time for what they wanted to do, so they decided that they were going to set up a municipal corporation. Not a for-profit corporation, a municipal corporation called the District of Columbia, but they were going to put a governor over it, and they set up the basic structure of this, which was modified over the years, and it applies to the limited. It didn't say Fort magazines, arsenals, and other needful buildings. It only said the 10-mile square. So I'm out here in California, and I'm about 3,000 miles away from that 10-mile square. There is no way that the jurisdiction created by that municipal corporation of that 100 square miles in Washington, D.C., extends to me, nor am I chattel to it. But, you know, if I mince words and kind of leave some things out, I can make it have a different appearance than that. Now, what got James and I back together after a dispute we had a while back over the Constitution itself was the fact that I recently wrote an article on the 14th Amendment. Now, if you read the article, and I'm willing to bet that James hasn't finished it yet, it goes back to the original documents. But I'm going to read a few points out of this so that we get an understanding of some things that are foundational to what most people want to assume creates an extended jurisdiction of that corporation and created in 1861. First was an act of Congress, March 3rd, 1825. The title of the act is an act more effectually to provide for the punishment of certain crimes against the United States and for other purposes. It begins with that if any person or persons within any fort, dockyard, navy yard, arsenal, armory, or magazine, the site whereof is ceded to and under the jurisdiction of the United States, or on a site of any lighthouse or other needful building belonging to the United States, the site whereof is ceded to them, the United States, and under their jurisdiction, as aforesaid, shall willfully, and it goes on, and sets crimes and penalties. Now, in 1825, Congress realized the limitations of their jurisdiction were those defined in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Now, it's hard to understand why they were in Waco, Texas, Ruby Ridge, Idaho, and any number of other places in this country if they understood back then that their jurisdiction was limited. That's a whole other story, and that was the purpose of me writing the 14th Amendment article. Now, if you go to my blog at outpost-of-freedom.com, go to the blog link, you'll find a very short introduction to the 14th Amendment article. The article itself, including the addendum, is 72 pages, I think. So it's rather extensive reading, but most of what you will be reading is what was written by them then, and not out of context. And I don't think what I just read is out of context. I left the detail out. Now we need to understand that there's an operation in this country called the Supreme Court of the United States. It goes by a number of names. One sounds like scrotum, something like that. And I think that's probably my favorite. No, that's SCOTUS. I'm sorry. The Supreme Court of the United States, was it Marshall in 1801, established a principle that was rather interesting. It was called judicial review. The case was Marbury versus Madison. The issue was John Adams had been president. He issued appointments in Washington, D.C. Remember, back then, before 1871, the government had to take care of these menial tasks of running a city. So he issued appointments within Washington, D.C. and within the government. Well, Jefferson came on board, and these certificates, these authorizations for these warrants for these people to take these positions had not been given to them yet. So Jefferson said, I don't like these guys. I'm not going to give them to them. Well, it doesn't matter the outcome. What matters more than anything was Marshall coming in and saying, and before that time, there was no judicial review. Judicial review, quite briefly defined, is the Supreme Court determining the constitutionality of a matter before it. So we have Jefferson saying, no, I don't have to give these out. I'm going to make my own appointments. And the Marbury, who one of the appointees, saying, you have to give them out because Adams issued them before you were president. So you got Congress on one side, saying the appointment should go. You got Jefferson on the other side saying, no, they shouldn't go. So the case goes to the Supreme Court. And Marshall basically said, when there is a dispute between the other branches of government, i.e. the executive and legislative branch of government, there is no other party that can resolve that dispute except the Supreme Court. Hence, judicial review came into being. It disappeared in 1937, but the concept originally was only when there's a dispute between, and so we're dealing with only the jurisdiction that applies in these Force Magazines, arsenals, and other municipal buildings, unless some other means carries that matter before the court, and unless there is a dispute between the executive and legislative branch. If the president acts and the Congress doesn't object, there is no justiciable issue before the SCOTUS court. So that's what judicial review is. That was 1825. Now, corporations were mentioned so very few times in Supreme Court decisions prior to 1852 that they're difficult to find. After 1867, though, in just a few years' time, there were over 263 cases that address corporation issues. And so all of a sudden you've got corporations after the Civil War going to the Supreme Court and trying to get this economic favor I'm talking about. Now, if we look at after the Civil War, say about 1899, 1900, somewhere around them, when the Supreme Court got involved in a matter, well, let's stop at Dred Scott first. Dred Scott's a rather interesting case, and we need to understand how jurisdiction extends. Dred Scott, we all remember from school, is where the Supreme Court said, if a horse runs away and you catch the horse, you got to return it to the owner. If a slave runs away and you catch the slave, you got to return it to the owner. There are two other aspects of Dred Scott that are very significant to understand what's gone wrong in this country. One of those is the fact that Dred Scott had no standing to take anything before the Supreme Court of the United States. However, Sanford did not object at the proper time, and so the court decided that, well, since Sanford didn't object, we will take the case. We will hear the case, even though we have no authority to, because it was not objected to timely. So in that Supreme Court decision, and I'm trying to find it right now, one thing that was established was the Supreme Court can hear cases if the jurisdiction over the parties is not challenged prior to it coming to that point. Keep that in mind. If you don't object to it going to the Supreme Court, it's too late when you get there to say, hey, you have no jurisdiction to hear what we wanted to talk about. Now, the other interesting thing in the Dred Scott case is the fact that Justice Taney, who gave the decision of the court, talked about who we the people are. Taney said, can a Negro whose ancestors were imported into this country and sold as slaves become a member of the political community formed and brought into existence by the Constitution of the United States, and as such become entitled to all rights and privileges and immunities guaranteed by that instrument to the citizens? Rights, privileges, and immunities guaranteed by that instrument to the citizens. Then he goes on for pages talking about who the people are, who we the people are, who the citizens of the United States, and yes, he used that phrase, who the citizens of the United States are. He went into great detail. Now, his definition is what was created by the Constitution. A subsequent definition was made in 1867 with the 14th Amendment, but the definition then even goes on to say, and no others. It was only those people that separated from England. And dozens of quotes in here from that case. It wasn't until after the 14th Amendment then came along and said that they created a new creature called citizen of the United States. There was no addressing it before. They did not say that they were bringing in people that were already citizens. They created, and many of the conversations that went on in the Senate of the United States during their consideration of the 14th Amendment are included in the article, so you can see exactly what they said. One guy says, I thought we were just talking about slaves. That's what came out of committee. But they broadened it to start including other people could be citizens of the United States, which they did. But what they did in the 14th Amendment is they granted privileges and immunity. Now, wait, we're missing something. Taney said rights, privileges, and immunities. The 14th Amendment only said privileges and immunities. Is that an oversight? I mean, it's only 20 years later, 30 years later, and you think these guys forgot that rights, privileges, and immunities were these elements that were protected the citizens of the United States? And they don't address this in the hundreds of pages of the Congressional Record. They do not, or Congressional Globe at the time, do not address that issue of rights, only of privileges and immunities. Now, if that's the case, they created a new class of citizen or a new definition for citizen of the United States. That new class of citizen was subject to the privileges and immunities, but not the rights. Now, wait a minute. What happens when you go to court and you say, what about my rights? What rights do you have? That Constitution doesn't belong in this court. Now, we're beginning to get a little broader picture in our relationship with the government as established by the court system. Then we come to 1937. We jump way up to 1937 in a case called Ashwander versus TVA. TVA was the Tennessee Valley Authority. Justice Brandeis, in a concurring opinion, established that gave us this information that the Supreme Court had established a policy whereby they would determine what cases would be heard by the court and how they would be dealt with. I'm going to paraphrase it. They had seven items. One of them says, we will not deal on the constitutionality of a matter before this court unless we have to. And then they went on. Anybody who seeks a benefit from an administrative agency is bound by the rules of that agency. So the Constitution doesn't apply anymore, only the rules of the agency. And it goes on and on. There are seven things that he points out. One was standing. Do you have standing? Only if you've been damaged by this. Now, wait a minute. But that came in a lawsuit against the 27th Amendment, the Congressional Pay Raise Amendment. A congressman and some citizens tried to challenge the law that Congress had passed, and on my blog you'll find an article on the 27th Amendment, the law that the Congress had passed that gives them perpetual annual raises unless they vote them down. And here you got the 27th Amendment says they can't have a pay raise until the next session of Congress, which is every 2 years. So about the time that it was ratified, Congress enacted a law to circumvent the amendment to the Constitution. The Supreme Court said, you're a congressman, you're citizens and taxpayers and got to pay their bill, but you don't have standing. You have not been injured by this. So by 1937, the scrotum, you know what that is, that's the ball sack that holds the balls, all nine of them, decided that they would not rule on the constitutionality if there was an administrative agency or if there was any other means of not ruling on the issue before them. Once that was done and the foundation was laid for our subjugation to administrative agencies, we go to 1946. 1946, the Administrative Procedures Act was enacted. The Congressional Globe for that period points out that one of the sponsors of the bill got on the floor of Congress and said, we are creating a fourth branch of government. They have rulemaking authority. Now, if you've ever heard the term positive law, now, most of the laws on the book are not positive. They're administrative agency rules. So if you're charged by the federal government with a crime, something, the section that you violated, if it's Title 26, I think that's IRS, if it's Title 26, for example, the administrative agency is in the Internal Revenue Service. So that's the administrative agency. They don't tell you that because they come under the style, back to the original definition that we talked about in judicial matters, the style of United States. So you see United States versus John Doe. You don't see the Internal Revenue Service versus John Doe, that definition that we talked about right at the beginning is the authority for them to come as the United States, not as the Internal Revenue Service. So you think the United States is after you, but in fact it's the Internal Revenue Service under that definition who's coming after you. And if you have a relationship with that administrative agency, then you're bound by the rules of the administrative agency with consequence thereof. Now, I mentioned 1899 or 1900 for a reason. There was a Supreme Court decision at the time called John Bad Elk versus United States. It was rather interesting because this guy came to arrest John Bad Elk. John Bad Elk didn't have, or he didn't have a warrant to arrest John Bad Elk. His boss told him to go arrest John Bad Elk. He was armed. John Bad Elk was in his house. The guy knocks on the door. John Bad Elk opens the door. The guy says, I've got to take you in. John says, I'll come in Monday. Tell him I'll be there Monday. No, I've got to take you in now. I've got to arrest you. John Bad Elk picks up his rifle. He shoots the guy dead. There was another deputy there. They don't say what the other deputy did, but he ran away or put his hands up or just started talking to John, played poker with him. I have no idea what happened to the other guy, but John Killsback lay dead on the floor because he tried to arrest John Bad Elk without a lawful warrant. The state then convicted John Bad Elk of murder. John Bad Elk appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of the United States said, absent a lawful warrant, you have every right to resist an unlawful arrest, even to the point of killing the officer, and that the crime that you commit could be a misdemeanor or no crime at all. Now, I'm not sure what the misdemeanor is, maybe discharge of a firearm within city limits, but they said it could be a misdemeanor or no crime at all if the guy tried to arrest you without a lawful warrant. Now, that's kind of hard to reconcile with the current case of Barnes versus Indiana, if you remember the one just a couple weeks ago, or another, that was the Indiana Supreme Court, or another one out of the United States Supreme Court called Kentucky versus King, where the Indiana one, they said, we're not going to discuss the legality of the entry. We're only going to discuss the fact that he has no right to resist an illegal entry by the police. And the other one, I haven't really read it through yet, the Kentucky versus King, both of these fly in the face of the Supreme Court decision in 1900. Now, did the Constitution change? Or did the rules by which the Supreme Court plays their game change? And are we getting results of administrative agency rule, where an administrative agency makes a rule that if I point a gun at you and say you're under arrest, you better drop your gun or otherwise you're guilty of a crime? Which, my favorite crime, what do they call it? Resisting arrest. Well, what was I being arrested for? Resisting arrest. But what was I being arrested for? Resisting arrest. Come with me. You know, there's no foundation. The Davidians were charged with use of a firearm and convicted of use of firearm in commission of a crime. However, they weren't convicted of a crime to use the firearms in. So you can see how convoluted law has gotten since Brandeis enlightened us in Ashwander to say that the Constitution doesn't matter anymore when you go to that building in Washington, D.C. with those nine people in dresses, black dresses. So when people assume that we're corporate chattel and under corporate law in this country, we're not. We're under administrative agency law.